All right. So what I'd like you to do is if you could describe how you came to addiction research. In other words, what was your pathway and what's your sort of disciplinary training and identification?
Well, I received my PhD as a biochemist from SUNY Buffalo. Yes, and then after biochemistry, I was thinking of what kind of postdoctoral position I should get into. And I talked to a friend of mine, and he told me that you should get into an area that is sort of more applied science in a way compared to the pure protein chemistry you have been doing as a student. So he suggested me to write to several people, and he is an alcohol addiction researcher. So he suggested me to me that how about Avram Goldstein at Stanford University? He is a very famous opioid researcher. So I wrote to Avram Goldstein, and Avram Goldstein replied to me, said, come over. So I joined Avram as a postdoctoral fellow.
What year was that?
That was 1975. So I joined Abram's lab. Yes. So there I started my addiction research career.
And had you been at all interested in the problems faced by addicts prior to that? Had you any familiarity with addicts?
Personally, no. But history-wise, you know, I came from Taiwan, and originally my ancestors came from China, and you know, the opioid war, etc. So it's a sort of things I know about this opioid addiction to some extent. And my grandma is interesting. She was born, of course, very early during the Qing Dynasty, and she told us something about how efficacious the opioid is, you know, if a child is sick with diarrhea, you know, those kind of just opioid small paste, amount of paste will cure it. And I heard about this when I was a child. Mm-hmm. But directly with the patient, no.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, so what initially, what was going on in Avram Goldstein's group at that time?
Very exciting.
Yeah.
I joined the lab in 1975. And Avram published a paper in the PNAS identifying the stereospecificity of opioid receptor binding. That was back in 1971. And then Saul Snyder at Johns Hopkins University, together with Kendris Pert, they modified it and found an excellent ligand to further demonstrate Avram Goldstein's concept in such a clear fashion. The specific binding arose from Avram's demonstration of 10% up to 90%. Mm-hmm. Saul Snyder specifically used radioactive naloxone, which is water soluble. So that was a big jump. That was in 1973. Saul Snyder published that in Science. So one of the meetings, people began to speculate whether there might be an endogenous compound in the brain that might act like a morphine. So this binding acid becomes such a powerful tool. Avram, of course, was just started to work on isolation of the brain extract, pituitary extract and blood extract to examine the possibility of endogenous ligand for opioid receptors. So I joined him in the middle of this hot race. That was 1975, September 1st, I joined his laboratory. So it was quite a competition right in the middle of it. So 1975, September, I remember Avram, he worked himself as a biochemist in the laboratory, and we worked together in the cold room. He was isolating something from pituitary, and I was trying to isolate something from the blood. And Brian Cox, by then, was the laboratory director, the laboratory manager. We were in the same laboratory, and Brian Cox was trying to isolate something from the pituitary in the brain also. So we are in a very hot race, and we know that there are at least three laboratories, other laboratories in the world that are competing for it. One is Hans Kosterlitz together with John Hughes, the other one is Saul Snyder, and the other one is Eric Simons, laboratory in New York. We know very well that we are all competing for the same goal. So we work very hard. I remember everyone worked till sometime 2 o'clock in the morning, and I myself work 3 o'clock in the morning, etc. And we actually we did it very well. We isolate a material which, when run in the gel electrophoresis, we saw three bands. You know, that means pretty good. You have only three protein left. So we assay it in the so-called guinea pig eating assay twitches, which you probably have seen the picture with me and Gordesky in the National Geographic. Yeah. And we used the assay, it was active, so we were very excited. And then, so we tried to scale it up, and we ran into some minor technical problem. But we were in the middle of pursuing it, and all in a sudden, it was in November, we received a Nature preprint from Hans Kosterlitz laboratory. That is John Hughes' work, ice purification of encapsulin. So we were so disappointed.
Yes.
Yeah, we received a preprint, we were so disappointed, and everyone was also so disappointed beyond anybody else. And so we decided to take a break. The laboratory took a break for 1 week. That was the first time I had a vacation, yeah, sort of during that time. But the excitement was sort of plunged, but everyone did not give up because we found something that was mainly everyone's the technician who has been working with everyone for close to 20 or 30 years, Louise, yeah. Her name is Louise, yeah. Louise, I forgot her. I forgot her last name. I just remember Louise.
With Everett May? Working with whom?
Working with Avram Goldstein.
With Avram,
yeah,
okay.
Working with Avram Goldstein for 20, 30 years. Very nice technician. She isolated something from pituitary. And this material acts quite different from encapsulin in the guinea pig eating twitch assay, because the action is long-lasting. Encapsulin acts in about 5 minutes, and it's over. But this material Louise isolated, purified, acts at least 30 minutes, long duration, and it was reversed by naloxone. So that was the excitement that came up after this sort of desperation of being a bit, being behind Hans Kosterlitz. And then they further continue to pursue that long-lasting material. It turned out to be kappa opioid endogenous ligand called dynorphin. So Hans Kosterlitz isolated, purified encapsulin, and Avram Goldstein got dynorphin.
And you were still there then?
Dynorphin sequence, that was, yes, I was there. I was still there. But not for long, because I left for Kentucky Lexington.
Right, and why did you do that?
Because for Abram has a tendency of turnover, the postdoctoral fellow. So he asked me that, Zhongping, perhaps it's good for you. Yeah, to go to another pastor. So I wrote to William Martin, Dr. Martin. I wrote a letter to Dr. Martin, and Dr. Martin said, I will be glad to have you, but I am leaving Addiction Research Center or University of Kentucky as a chairperson. I have thus given your letter to Don Jasinski. Mm-hmm. So Jasinski called me and give me an interview and hire me right away.
So it was just at that moment when they were transitioning.
Yes.
So when you got there, Jasinski was completely in charge, or was he sharing that responsibility with
Gordetsky?
Gordetsky, okay. Okay, and what did you think you were going to?
Before I left for Lexington, Kentucky, I asked Avram. I asked Avram and said to him, Avram, what do you think would be a meaningful project you think I should pursue at Lexington, Kentucky? And he told me that, well, Dr. Martin has just published a paper in JPAD. He proposed that there are three types of opioid receptors, mu, kappa, and sigma. So he suggested to me that as a biochemist, perhaps you should try to demonstrate biochemically what, you know, mu receptor is probably has been well done, you know. She said you probably should look for kappa or sigma opioid receptors.
And is that in fact what you did?
I have been doing sigma receptor for 26 years, ever since.
Mm-hmm. And the sigma receptor is not an opioid.
No.
It turns out. It
turned out to be non-opioid.
At what point did you discover that?
In 1982, I used the prototypic sigma opioid receptor ligand as proposed by Dr. Martin. That is a racemic form of SKF1. 10047. Yeah. This racemic mixture proposed by Dr. Martin is a prototypic sigma ligand, which causes delusional and stereotypic movement in the spinal dog. And he asked Paul Gilbert to examine this and ask him if this effect was reversed by naloxone. According to Paul Gilbert, he said, yeah, it was reversed by naloxone. So Dr. Martin called it psychotomimetic sigma opioid receptors. And so that was the start of the so-called sigma opioid receptors. So when I use this racemic compound plus minus mixture of SKF10047 radioactive and use a brain homogenate and do the binding assay, I found a binding site that is nowadays so-called sigma receptor. But by then, I demonstrated and found that this binding site actually is resistant to naloxone. So when I published this paper, the name sigma / opioid receptor remains in the title. And that was a sort of inappropriate, mm-hmm. because the definition of opioid is that the effect should be reversed or blocked by naloxone. And this binding assay I demonstrated in 1982 is resistant to naltrexone, naloxone. So actually, it was a mistake to have the opioid there. Mm-hmm. But the story is more complicated than that. So two years later, I began to realize that this so-called sigma opioid receptor is insensitive to naltrexone. So it should not be called an opioid receptor. The name opioid may have to be dropped, but I have no evidence except the binding assay. So it waited until Dr. Bruce Vopel. Bruce Vopel, V-A-U-P-E-L. He repeat Paul Gilbert's experiment. in the spinal dog. I believe he repeated in 1983. Paul Gilbert's study was in 1976. So Bruce repeated and found that the stereotypic hallucinational effect caused by spinal dog caused by plus minus mixture of SKF was resistant to naloxone. So he published this paper in 1983 saying that the SKF racemic effect in the spinal dog, so-called delusional effect, was not an opioid effect. So here comes the confusion. So what is Bruce's effect? What was Bruce's observation? In fact, Bruce's observation, he realized that the effect he has seen is that the dose of plus minus SKF compound binds to the PCP receptor site, phencyclidine receptor site. So from the behavior study, we can almost summarize that. 1976 observation that the plus minus SKF effect was reversed by naloxone may have been a mistake. And in 1983, Bruce Wopel observed that the SKF effect observed in Dr. Martin's original observation might have been mediated by phencyclidine NMDA receptor complex. That is not opioid receptor.
Right.
Yeah. So here comes the question of my binding result. That's where the confusion comes from. And I don't know whether this is related to your study or not, but now the sigma receptor has become a long story. But let me tell you what the story ends and where it does stand now. So the binding site I demonstrated in 1982 as a racemic SKF binding site, from a mistake, sigma opioid receptor, it was a mistake. So we drop that opioid, we call it sigma receptor. But is this sigma receptor responsible for the stereotypic delusional effect of plus minus SKF 24/7? We don't know. Because apparently the behavior data from Bruce Wopel has told us that it's from the PCP NMDA site. So where is this protein doing? I mean, what is this protein doing that I identified in 1982 as the so-called sigma opioid receptor? We decided to call it sigma receptor then. Mm-hmm. We drop the opioid name and let's call it sigma receptor. The answer is the behavioral consequence of sigma receptor. We don't know much at all. Sigma receptor, I would like to call it, it was a protein without any known pharmacology. So I have been doing a reverse pharmacology ever since 1982.
Explain what you mean by
reverse pharmacology. Nowadays, with the advances of molecular biology, people clone and sequence a protein. And usually, if you clone a new protein, you compare with a database of all the known protein sequences, right? Then, if it does not match, does not resemble any of the known sequence, then you are doing an orphan protein without any relative. That's what sigma receptor was. The binding was done in 1982, as I demonstrated, and many people have confirmed that, including Saul Snyder's. Not until 1996, the protein was sequenced.
And have you worked on it the whole time?
Yes. I work on the sigma receptor about 50%. And I also work on the another opioid peptide for about 50%. Yeah.
Okay.
But if we complete the sigma side story, I may be able to tell a little bit about the opioid Yeah, peptides. That has something to do with the hypernatia.
Okay. I'd like you to talk, if you could, about what Lexington was like as a research environment. Now, it's interesting because you're telling me a story about an era. I visited Charles Gordetsky in Kansas City, and I've had a whole afternoon's interview with Don Jasinski. So I've spoken with them about that period. But you're actually coming into a period in Lexington that I don't know as well as I feel like I know the former period. So if you could talk about what that was like as a research environment, especially given that you've got this fascinating, you've got Avram Goldstein's lab as a research environment, and then you've got Lexington. If you could talk about how research questions got generated and talked about, mm-hmm. and that would be really interesting.
Mm-hmm. The research environment in Lexington, where I was in, it has a... I remember I joined the Lexington when Dr. Martin was being transferred to Kentucky. So I still have a personal, first-hand experience with him for a little while before he moved over, mm-hmm. and also because it's so close to him. And this uniqueness I remember then, because I still remember very clearly, is that no seminar has lasted less than 2 hours. The speaker spoke, Dr. Martin interfered. He encouraged other people to participate in the discussion. And usually a typical seminar lasts for about 2 to 3 hours. And Dr. Martin, being such a great scientist, he provided extremely insightful questions, and he sometimes can put the speaker on the spot. But it was that time that I have learned that how a great brain works and how amazing, what I admire Dr. Martin most is that he is able to face a humongous amount of data. And he could organize it and then sort of digest it and then come up with some very passive, very insightful, out of nowhere, parsimonious hypothesis. And that's how he got his multiple opioid receptor hypothesis. Amazing. And that applied to Avram Goldstein as well. Avram's laboratory meeting, weekly laboratory meeting, is a time that, again, we saw a rare species of grand brain spinning and working, and he can ask questions out of you know, the side view, side perspective, and then you realize that, oh, that's the most critical. So I that's the most important thing I learned from those two people. And the seminar tradition applied to Jasinski also. Mm-hmm. Dan Jasinski also had a very nice long session of seminars, and also he took the opportunity to educate those young people. I mean, inadvertently are influencing us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So during the Lexington days, we have, I mean, at least in my laboratory, I have a very small laboratory, but I have complete freedom. I have complete freedom to do what I was doing. And looking back, I appreciated the Addiction Research Center most, is that I have been pursuing this research, say sigma receptor, which is seemingly untargeted for so many years. It was not until the recent 2 years that we begin to understand that this protein has a relation with addiction. And that's what I'm going to talk about this Wednesday in the symposium. Yeah.
So you mean, did you just tell me that you have been pursuing this for the past 20 years and you didn't really see the relation to addiction until the last two?
The molecular level. Mm-hmm. This protein has been speculated to be related to psychostimulant addiction.
Yes.
Because cocaine and methamphetamine action, say cocaine-induced condition place preference, or cocaine-induced behavior sensitization, and this applies to methamphetamine also, they can be antagonized by so-called sigma receptor antagonist. And the reason is very simple, because this receptor bind cocaine and methamphetamine in a binding assay. Not with great affinity, but they do have affinity for that. So for many years, back in 1990, people began to realize, oh yes, regarding to this receptor, the affinity of cocaine binding to this receptor was demonstrated by Michael Kuha. By Mike Kuha's group. So that particular paper actually has a great impact, and Mike did not realize that. Mm-hmm. Because of his demonstration, people began to use the sigma 1 antagonist to block cocaine and the methamphetamine effect, and it was working, but that was back in 1990. And what I mean by not until the recent 2 years that we begin to realize this relation to addiction, I was referring to the molecular mechanism. Mm-hmm. So we have to modify that a little bit. So since 1990, this orphan protein has been demonstrated to have an affinity with cocaine, as demonstrated by Kuha's group. But the molecular mechanism really was not really understood to some extent until about 1 or 2 years ago. And most likely, most recently.
So what you appreciated about the Addiction Research Center in relation to that was that you were allowed to pursue this.
Definitely. In the past, I joined the foundation, Addiction Research Center in 1978. I started working on this protein. So for 26 years, my laboratory has never been closed down. So I think that is a great part of the Addiction Research Center, that they do not discourage a young scientist, and I think that's a great thing. In other words, it's a long-term investment, and I think that's great for the purpose of the existence of NIH. Mm-hmm. Of course, it may turn out to be failure, right? I mean, it's a risk. It's a high risk to support a young scientist with untargeted protein research. So for 26 years, I think the Addiction Research Center has been invested in a long-term untargeted research, at least as far as my project is concerned. Mm-hmm. And that I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. So you were in Lexington 1978
to 1984.
1984, when everybody moved.
Yes.
Okay, so you were there for those must have been somewhat discouraging years, because the prisoner research program shut down. People must have been somewhat demoralized about not being able to continue the kind of research that they were doing, the clinical people. What was that like?
Terrible turmoil. It was a terrible turmoil. I arrived in 1978. Dr. Martin called me to his office and explained to me why we have to shut down the addiction research, human research in Lexington, Kentucky. He told me that the Civil Liberty Union group has sued the federal government.
The ACLU?
Yes, if I'm right. Yeah. You can look into that. And they sue the federal government. You probably heard it from some other people that we don't have any right to use a human prisoner as a volunteer for research. So we lost the lawsuit. So we have to move. Yeah. And 1978, when I got there, they were discussing the location to move this research center. They have several different potential locations, and it was, I think, I don't remember which year they decided to choose Baltimore as the next
station. Yeah, I
have
that actually from Don.
Yeah.
They looked at several sites and that.
Exactly. So the morale was low, people don't know, especially the technicians, they're all local people.
Yes.
And they don't want to move, they know that they are moving, but they don't want to move. So it was a terrible transition time, for a lot of people. But the individual scientists kept the experiment going, because science is science, and until we are told to wrap up the equipment, etc., we just kept on working.
So did that sort of transitional sense last the entire time you were still there? Did you keep working with the idea that you were moving from 1978 to 1984?
Right.
That must have been really hard.
Yes, very tough. Although we know that everything is going to be moved and wrap up, and not until we got the official notice. So my personal, say for my own laboratory, we wrap up. Pack up everything, and that was not too bad on my portion. Yeah, mm-hmm. The other people's I don't know. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But on my part, it was not too bad.
Okay, so you moved to Baltimore.
Yes.
With everybody, are you there now? Are you still on that campus?
I'm still in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm still in Baltimore.
Right. So you stayed as you became the IRP.
Yes.
Okay. And tell me how you felt as a member of what became the intramural program. For a long time, you retained the identity of the ARC, even after the move.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I guess with Leshner, you became the IRP. Can you talk a little bit about your sense of how the intramural program, how the ARC was viewed by, you call headquarters?
Mm-hmm. NIH headquarters, you mean?
Yes.
How the NIH headquarters view the ARC, I don't have political insight into it. However, the sense I felt when they were talking about eliminating the name ARC into the IRP, I was one of the 14 PhDs moving from Lexington, Kentucky to Baltimore. And when we heard that the Addiction Research Center is going to be eliminated, the name is going to be changed to IRP, at least as a researcher, my immediate reaction is, oh, that's why they are going to emphasize neuroscience. That's my first reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And being trying to emphasize the neuroscience, NIH is very famous for basic science.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
So molecular science, etc., is very strong at NIH. And the Addiction Research Center, to my view, is they don't think the Addiction Research Center is doing enough molecular science.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're going to change to IRP because we don't have a strong molecular mechanism as a group. We have some hypothesis, the most famous mu kappa, sigma. research by Martin, but we have been doing something that I thought that was the reason why they mm-hmm. wanted, but maybe more than that. You probably heard it from some other people.
Well, no, I think that's a nice little anecdote. It's great. Okay, can you remember who the 14 were?
Yes, I think so. Let me try.
Okay.
Edward Cohn, C-O-N-E.
Yeah.
Ed Johnson.
Yeah.
Bruce Whopell. Wally Pickworth. James Bell. Hutton. Charles Hutton. H-A-R-T-0-E-N. T-Z-E-N.
Yes.
Jack Hutton. Gordesky, of course. Jasinski.
Yourself.
Myself. Harlan Shannon. Steve Goldberg. Stanley Yeh. Y-E-H. Yes. Mark Reisner. R-E-I-S-N-E-R. Did I miss anybody? PhD level. How many we have?
13.
13. We missed one. I call myself. Stay here. Mark Reisner. Jack. Bruce. And we may have missed one. Yeah, I guess could not recall.
And how many of them had been there less than you had?
Less than I'm the youngest.
You're the youngest, yeah,
the youngest
of those.
Yes.
Okay.
The youngest addition. I mean.
Yes.
Yeah. Addition.
Right. And did you find in the years after that there was any, were you accorded respect or value for having been at Lexington? Was there for a while a sort of effect of, you know, Lexington as a kind of important place?
For my research.
Amongst your peers.
Can you elaborate your question?
Well,
again?
Let me tell you where it's coming from, and then maybe
sure.
It'll be. Lexington plays this interesting role where sometimes it's kind of the golden years. It's this incredible place. It has a almost magical quality, the way that people speak about it. And yet outside, it's kind of subordinated. It was an isolated place. It was off the beaten path. It wasn't on a trade route. Those kinds of comments get made about it. And so I'm, as a historian, I'm always sort of bouncing between those two images. And people who were there do talk about it as a kind of golden age,
yes.
Right? So could you kind of talk about the sort of status of Lexington?
Lexington. The glory of Lexington is that it's amazing that from the descriptive human pharmacology can come such a great hypothesis that affects opioid researchers ever since 1976. So my recollection of Lexington is that it's a network of researchers that seems to be asking very basic questions all the time. And my greatest memory of Lexington is that that's about what we're doing every day. I mean, where's the idea is, what an idea? We are totally, I mean, some people told me though, that is from one of the Lexington people, you know what? Dr. Martin has protected us in a, into a, such an environment that we are severed from all political factors that might have affected us, but he has protected us from all that kind of unnecessary things, factors, that we are in a huge, big environment that we are so free to explore very, very basic questions in science. Mm-hmm. And that is reflected again in his endless pursuit of asking questions in seminars. Mm-hmm. And we all seems to be in that big environment. And to me, personally, that period in Lexington, Kentucky has affected me, because now what I'm doing is all purely molecular cell biological science, but I think that Lexington years has influenced me so much. I always try to link the molecule science and and the neuroscience with the global picture, which mm-hmm. I have gained from Dr. Martin mm-hmm. and from my colleagues in Lexington years. And I think that impacted me profoundly. And that's why I told my fellow now, you hear this? I try to, in the discussion, I put my opinion in, and they can connect to the global mm-hmm. picture of what they're doing.
And can you give me a sense of how you think about that global picture? Right, so when you make that move from the molecular to the global, what's the global? Fill that in for me. Mm-hmm.
I think the molecular biology has advanced in such a great extent in the past 10 years. And that applying to other medical field is probably okay. Say heart disease, you know, mm-hmm. cholesterol, you know, receptor, et cetera, it's okay. But when it comes to the addiction science, it's there's a sense that I need to have my fellow connected of what they're doing to the addiction. Mm-hmm. And the fellows nowadays, they have ample knowledges and technologies of molecular biology, cell biology, but they don't have the background that I have exposed myself to in Lexington years. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when I'm thinking about addiction, I know, this is a neural network and all those insight, how a single cell can affect. In other words, they don't have the behavioral input, they don't have the some knowledges that I have gained personally from those Lexington years, mm-hmm. they don't have. Mm-hmm. And that is a very, very, not only my own opinion, but people have this molecular biology, they advance so much, they focus on this and this, what has that to do with addiction? Sometimes they don't know. Mm-hmm. And I have been trying to link this to my fellow, that you have to remember that there's a link to this addictive processes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, everyone who I've met talks about the loss of Lexington. They see it as a loss. And they talk about that.
I agree with that. The loss of Lexington is that I don't think Lexington, the spirit or the pursue a pure. I mean, the uniqueness of Lexington is that people has never lost sight of the word addiction in their mind. Yeah, it's always in our mind. I'm a pure biochemist, yes, but in my mind, that is something we always have focused on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then that's why we have a very interesting great model, Dr. Martin, doing the human pharmacology, analyzing this behavioral problem, and then come up with a molecular hypothesis. And that kind of great model I never forgot. Mm-hmm. And I would say it's more difficult for people from the molecular basis to reverse to this global addictive process of things. And that is something I think we are lacking.
So, let's see, we're coming up on an hour. How are you doing?
I'm okay.
Is there anything that I didn't ask that you can recall or you would want included in this kind of an interview? This is actually great. The material on Lexington and... You've confirmed some of my hypotheses as a historian, actually, because I similarly believe and am sort of writing about that process of the difficulty of reversing
yes.
the process.
I have one thing to say, that one of the challenges to produce young scientist to do the addiction research is how to provide an environment that will integrate this young molecular or cell biological scientist into the domain that he may have the basic knowledge, clinical knowledge to some extent, psychological knowledge to some extent, to integrate into his thinking process. I think that is what is lacking in our current setting. That's it. Integration.
Yeah.
The integration of addiction research and the uniqueness of addiction research is such an integrating place
mm-hmm.
from the clinical, psychological, all the way to the molecular sense. Everything is in such an environment that impact a young scientist.
Mm-hmm.
That is very difficult to have nowadays.
Yes, and you felt, and that was the experience that you had.
Oh, yes. And I value it so much. Mm-hmm. I value it so much.
Yeah, it's actually pretty incredible for if you look at the disciplinary affiliations of people at this conference and you listen to the different kinds of languages that they use to express their ideas, they're quite unintegrated. And to try to integrate them, I think, is very difficult.
The CBDD has the uniqueness of caring a shadow, a beautiful, glorious shadow of ARC. How to amplify it, how to install it into some other research institute, I think that's a great challenge.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much.
Well, a great pleasure.